Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, July 30th, 2025. And on today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll talk about the Fantastic Four First Steps, and we'll also talk about Happy Gilmore 2, and we'll present an interview with the director of that movie. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and it's just me in the news segment today. Before we get to that, though, I did want to just tell listeners that next week's episode will almost certainly come out a day later than usual. I wanted to apologize in advance about that. There's some travel stuff, some scheduling stuff. It just can't be helped. So that is probably what's going to happen. So stay tuned for next Thursday to get an episode of the show instead of on Wednesday. Okay, so let's jump into the news. I think the biggest industry-related news is that the merger between Skydance and Paramount has finally cleared the FCC. There are probably going to be a bunch of knockdown effects from that that we can talk about when that actually happens. But this deal has been in the works for a long time. David Ellison, who is the now chairman and CEO of Skydance Media and is going to be the effectively number one at Paramount, is a producer who is the son of one of the world's richest men. And David Ellison has been producing movies for Paramount for a long time, but we're talking about like Star Trek movies and Terminator movies and Mission Impossible movies, like a lot of big time franchise films. And now he is taking over the entire studio, basically. So we'll see what this actually looks like in practice, but this is something that's been talked about a lot. There's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not this deal would actually go through. There have been capitulations made to the current presidential administration to make sure that the deal goes through. Stephen Colbert and The Late Show have been canceled in a fashion that seems pretty politically motivated. And yeah, there are just a lot of irons in this particular fire, but now it seems like the final obstacle has been overcome in terms of this merger. So we'll see if this signals brighter days ahead for Paramount. One of the things that got caught up in this is South Park and the deal between Trey Parker and Matt Stone and Paramount and Comedy Central and the streaming rights to South Park and what their future is going to be. Basically, they signed a $1.5 billion deal for the next 5 years to make 50 more episodes of South Park. And they came out really hot in the season 27 premiere skewering Donald Trump, and I'm sure you've seen all sorts of headlines about that. We have a couple good articles up on Slash Film if you missed that whole thing and are just curious from a pop culture standpoint what this means. And that episode came out before the deal went through, so I think there was some concern or question about whether or not their basically middle finger to the president was going to have any impact on the FCC actually approving the Skydance and Paramount merger, but that ended up not being the case. So that deal has gone through. But yeah, you can check out those South Park related stories at slashfilm.com. Coyote versus Acme, which is a Will Forte comedy where it's a live action animated hybrid that was abandoned by Warner Brothers and now picked up by Ketchup Entertainment not too long ago, now has a release date, which is August 28th, 2026, which is a lot further down the road than I expected that we would be able to see this movie. But there was a big Comic-Con panel and they showed some footage of it there. So you can read more about that if you're interested. But yeah, just add that to your calendar because that's going to be one that I think a lot of people are going to be very curious to see how that pans out. So Coyote versus Acme at least finally has a release date. So that's a good sign. Next up, I wanted to mention really quick that a Wolfenstein TV series is in development. This is going to be at Amazon Prime Video. Patrick Somerville, who is a guy who worked on Station 11. He was the executive producer and the showrunner on Station 11, which is a show that I personally didn't love, but I know a lot of people really, really, really liked that show a lot. It came out during the kind of peak era of the pandemic, and it spoke to a lot of folks. I really liked the book, but I thought the TV adaptation was kind of a disaster personally. He also, Somerville, worked on Maniac at Netflix, which is a show that, despite it being on Netflix, I'm guessing more people probably ended up watching Station 11 or at least heard of it. Maniac seems like a show that basically doesn't exist, but that is really unfortunate because I thought it was really terrific. Jonah Hill and Emma Stone are in it, and I think it's worth going back and checking out if you missed that one at the time. but he is going to be the brains behind this adaptation. For those who don't know what Wolfenstein is, it's a series of video games where basically you're playing a World War II American soldier who discovers that the Nazis are working on secret cult-related experiments, and things go really, really poorly, and gigantic mutant creatures get involved, and you're basically, it's a first-person shooter type of thing where you're just blowing away a bunch of Nazis. And actually, the plot synopsis of this show just says, the story of killing Nazis is evergreen, which is just an amazing synopsis. They don't give any details about what the show actually is. That's all they say. And yeah, fully agree with that. So yeah, I'm really curious to see just like how hardcore they go in terms of the violence here and what they're going to end up doing and whether people are in the mood to see something like that, because it certainly seems like they could be given what's going on in the world these days. Jonah Nolan and Lisa Joy are going to be among the executive producers of this show. So stay tuned for more information about that. It's coming on Amazon Prime Video at some point in the future. And lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about Predator and what Dan Trachtenberg has done with Predator Killer of Killers, which is the animated movie that is on Hulu right now. It's the anthology film. We talked about that on the podcast not too long ago. And Dan Trachtenberg, who is the kind of overseer, the creative overseer of the Predator franchise these days, appeared in Hall H at Comic-Con this year, and he showed off some new footage that has been added to the kind of post-credits or mid-credits section of Predator Killer of Killers. If you go on Hulu right now and watch the movie, it will look different than if you had watched it the day that movie dropped on Hulu. And what has been added is now you can see the animated recreations of Danny Glover's character from Predator 2 and also Arnold Schwarzenegger's character from the original Predator in the kind of cryo sleep chambers next to Naru, the character from Prey that Trachtenberg also directed. So those two characters have been in the universe of this movie, captured and preserved in the Predator homeworld or in the Predator community in some fashion for some sort of nefarious purpose, presumably, or maybe like a massive team-up fight of the greatest people that they've ever fought as a race or whatever. So I'm really curious to see what ends up happening there. Trachtenberg talked about how he had a breakfast with Arnold Schwarzenegger and talked about things they could make together, and Arnold approved his cameo in the movie. So I guess, I don't know if that breakfast did not happen in time for this footage to be added to Killer of Killers when it actually hit the service originally, or if they always planned on doing this timed to Comic-Con just to kind of rejuice people's interest in this film and maybe get people to rewatch it or get people to watch it who skipped it when it first came around. But regardless, it's kind of an interesting situation here. It's edging like a little toward George Lucas territory for me, I think, in terms of just now the version that we watched on Hulu, as far as I know, is just no longer available. Like that is now the canonical version of this movie. So I'm not really thrilled with that, but also it's like 10 extra seconds of footage and it's not that big of a deal. So anyway, just some interesting sort of larger picture takeaways or something to think about for what this could mean for how filmmakers treat their projects or what have you. But just in terms of like the actual content of what we're seeing here, that's exciting stuff. And I wonder if that is a thing that's actually happened in the Predator universe as established by this movie. Maybe there's a way to get an older version of Schwarzenegger into a live action thing. The version of Dutch that we see in this animated form is a younger version of the character. So they would have to do something probably in animation first, and maybe then that could set the table for a potential live action return for Schwarzenegger. But anyway, this is stuff that Dan Trachtenberg is probably thinking about now. And I'm sure people will be asking him about that in the years to come. So yeah, just a really cool little credits tag that's been added to that movie. So check that out if you are interested, if you're a big fan of the Predator world and what this could mean for future projects going forward. And that is going to do it for the news segment. And now I'm going to bring somebody on for our next segment here. With me now for another edition of Jacob's Trailer Park is Slash Film Editor Jacob Hall.
Hey, Ben, how's it going?
I'm doing very well, Jacob. We have a ton of trailers to talk about today, and we're actually recording this approximately a week in advance, but we couldn't fit it into last week's episode. So there's a chance that a bunch more trailers might have debuted between now and when people are listening to this. But if that's the case, we'll catch up with them on a future episode. But
by the time people are hearing this, they have almost assuredly seen the Avatar 3 trailer, which we cannot talk about just yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, as always, people can check out slashfilm.com to stay up to date on the biggest, flashiest trailers out there. If the Avatar trailer has debuted by the time you're listening to this, I'm sure we'll have at least one article up on Slash Film breaking that down in some capacity. But, Jacob, let's dive into what we're here to talk about today. And I want to start with a trailer for After the Hunt, which is an Amazon MGM movie that's directed by Luca Guadagnino. It stars Julia Roberts, Iowa Debris, and Andrew Garfield. And it's like a college, like a Me Too type of adult drama. So what'd you make of this one?
The point of Jacob's Trailer Park is sometimes to talk about the trailer itself and not the actual movie. This looks like it's going to be a terrific movie. I love Guadagnino's work. It's a hell of a cast. You didn't say that Michael Stuhlbarg's back with Guadagnino here, and I'm all for that reunion. Man, this trailer is so, like, sloppily edited, and nothing about this trailer sells me that this would be a compelling movie other than me being aware of the talent. So as a trailer, this is like a 6 out of 10 on my Jacob's Trailer Park rating here. But I know for a fact this movie's going to be terrific just because of the talent involved. But if I did not know who Luca Guadagnino was, and I watched this trailer, I would have no desire to watch this movie. It is just, whoever edited this needs to go back to trailer editing school. It's my opinion on this, Ben.
Wow. Okay. That's a strong take there. So tell me what you thought about the teaser trailer for Keeper, which is the new movie from Oz Perkins, who's the guy behind Long Legs and The Monkey. And I think Hannah Shaw Williams, one of our editors, pointed out that this is going to be his third movie in something like 18 months. So this guy is just like pumping films out left and right these days.
Yeah, I'm a pretty big Oz Perkins fan. I love Long Legs. I really like The Monkey. His early movie, The Black Coat's Daughter, is just like an all-timer for me. This teaser, it's very much a teaser. It is very much like, hey, this movie exists kind of thing. And it's mostly, you know, vague, undefined imagery with a little hint of horror towards the end. So I have a hard time rating this as a great trailer. So I'm going to say a 5 out of 10 on the trailer, but I am excited for more Oz Perkins. I'm glad he's working as often as he is. I'm glad that Neon seems to have like scooped him up. I mean, Oz Perkins is essentially saying, what if I made A24 horror movies, but over at Neon instead? And I'm all for that. I'm all for Neon and A24 having a horror movie war. Ben, I think this is very important for the industry.
100%, yeah. Okay, so what about the trailer for Stranger Things season 5, the final season of Stranger Things? I think this was like number one on YouTube's charts for trending movie trailers for a long, long time.
Okay, Ben, this is where I admit in public, I've said this before at work and in private, I stopped watching Stranger Things after season 1. So I am woefully behind on this show. I can't tell you anything that's going on in this trailer. I mean, it's well cut enough. I mean, it sells as being a big deal, I suppose. And I'm happy for the people who enjoyed this show. But season 1, I watched and I said, okay, that's enough Stranger Things for me. And I haven't gone back. So I'm giving this a question mark out of 10 because I am no position to judge this trailer. But you know what? The people who are on staff who still have caught up with the show, they seem to like this trailer. They seem excited. And I hope everybody's ready to see some 28-year-old high school students finish their journey.
Yeah, man, I'm like, by the time Stranger Things season 4 wrapped up, I was kind of on board. Like that season won me over. And then I'm looking at the run times for the final season, and like every episode is like movie length. And it's just, I'm pre-exhausted thinking about having to watch Stranger Things season 5, which is not the feeling that anybody wants or should want. I guess the best news is that they're breaking up the season and spreading it out. They're releasing some of it in during Thanksgiving, some of it during Christmas, and I think the final episode on New Year's Eve. So at least it's not like, hey, here's, you know, eight or nine movies that you all have to, you have to watch entirely in one day or weekend or whatever, to avoid being spoiled or something. At least they're spreading it out a little bit, but man, yeah, I'm kind of dreading the experience of watching this, but then it'll be over and we don't have to think about it again. So next up, Mortal Kombat 2. This is a movie that we've talked a lot about on Slack, but I'm curious for you to share your thoughts with the public here.
All right. I'm Mortal Kombat 1 hater. I think that original movie, the first movie from a few years ago, is actively truly terrible. Like, there's almost nothing redeemable about it. It is just completely misses the mark on what anybody would want out of a Mortal Kombat movie. That said, the trailer for Mortal Kombat 2 is freaking awesome. I love this trailer. It is bloody and campy and silly and has all the hallmarks of what I want out of Mortal Kombat, which is people from various different corners of a mystical fighting universe tearing each other limb for limb, with Johnny Cage, played by the great Carl Urban, center stage here, to the point where that they clearly seem to be asking you to forget about the original film, because the main character of the original film is in like two shots this trailer, completely backgrounded, which makes you think they heard the complaints or maybe soft rebooting this in a way. I am letting my hopes ride high on this trailer, Ben. I'm hoping they don't break my heart. 8 out of 10 trailer.
Yeah, this absolutely should have just been the first movie. It looks like a lot of fun and very, very different from the first film, which was kind of dour and didn't really have the same level of like magic and supernatural nonsense that kind of makes that fighting franchise as fun as it actually is. Okay, Tron Ares, the Jared Leto-fronted, long-awaited sequel to Tron Legacy. What'd you make of the new trailer for this one?
See, this is where I feel like I need to... Okay, so I was at D23 a little while back when they showed the first footage from Tron Ares. It was a teaser that I don't think ever actually hit online, and it was a very early piece of footage, and it was the first time they debuted music from Nine Inch Nails and revealed that Nine Inch Nails was doing music for the film itself. And I was really, really impressed with that footage. I was like trying to relate to the folks back at home for our written articles. This looks really cool. It looks spooky and eerie. And it has like this sort of like real horror movie vibe going on. It seems like it's really focused on like the Tron universe as a nightmare invading our reality. And the music seemed to like really accommodate that vision. And now I feel really stupid because this new trailer doesn't have any of that. It feels nothing like the first teaser I saw at D23. It looks so generic and stupid. And I don't want to see Jared Leto's dumb face ever again, Ben. Nothing about that man is appealing. Nothing about that man is appealing as a movie star or an actor. And I just want him to go away forever. And I don't know. I've always appreciated the aesthetic of Tron, but Tron 1 is not a good movie. It's one you put it on mute and it's fine. Same with Tron Legacy. You put it on mute and people are talking, let the soundtrack blast and you're fine. But they're not actual good movies. I was hoping Tron Ares would win me over, but this trailer makes you feel like a dummy for thinking that original teaser I saw at D23 was going to be a change of pace. 4 out of 10 trailer.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I am actually not even a huge fan of the Nine Inch Nails song that debuted in this trailer, and that seems like an opinion that goes against the grain from a lot of stuff. At least I saw a lot of people being like, hell yeah, this music is amazing. And I was just kind of like, I think I prefer the Daft Punk score from Tron Legacy, at least to what we've heard so far. But I'll reserve my full judgment for when the movie comes out. So Fixed is the next movie from, I think it's Gennady Tartakovsky, the guy behind like Dexter's Laboratory and Samurai Jack. He's a very famous animation director.
Don't forget, more than a few Hotel Transylvanias.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He was the mastermind behind the Hotel Transylvania universe. He has moved over to Netflix to make this movie called Fixed, which is an animated comedy about a dog who discovers that he's going to be neutered. And it is a very, very hard R-rated movie. So tell me what you thought about this trailer.
So expectations in check here. One of our writers saw this film at an early screening at the Annecy Film Festival earlier this year, and he came back saying it's really funny and was raving about it. And since then, I know somebody else who's watched it who says it's wild and really worth seeing and very funny and strange, the appeal being that it has that sort of you know, it's a Tarkovsky like animation style. You know, see in Primal and Samurai Jack and his Clone Wars series, but you know, the original one that was hand animated, Dexter's Laboratory, that whole style, but being utterly filthy is kind of the joke. Is that it looks like a Cartoon Network show from 2002 that is full of, you know, the most depraved humor imaginable. But this trailer is awful. This is a truly bad trailer. If the movie is as funny as I'm told it is, this trailer is not selling it. It's not selling me on the movie or the tone or the comedy. It just looks really unpleasant. It looks like it, based on this footage, this is a movie that you'd have to pay me to sit through. I'm still going to check it out because two people have told me it is funny. But this is not the trailer Netflix should have released. This is not something that I would have put in front of millions of potential viewers and said, hey, make sure you watch this later this year because this ain't it, Ben.
Yeah, man, I'm glad you said that because I thought I was the kind of loser who was like, I don't consider myself too prudish, but I was like, Jesus, this trailer, man, this is rough. And I didn't really think it was funny. So I'm glad that we're in the same boat on that. Yeah, maybe we'll talk more about that movie once it actually comes out.
Apparently it's his like passion project. Apparently he's been dreaming of making a movie for like 20 years. And I'm watching his trailer and going, I don't get it. There must be something here. If somebody as respected as him, who's, you know, paid his dues with the Hotel Transylvania movies, but has also made stuff that people genuinely admire and love, like Primal and Samurai Jack. I just don't know, man. This is like a 1 out of 10 trailer. Nothing about this trailer is appealing in any way whatsoever.
Yeah, it's really rough. On the total opposite end of the spectrum, we have the teaser trailer for Hoppers, which is a Pixar movie, very, very family friendly, as opposed to the gnarly, filthy nonsense of Fixed. So they call out Avatar specifically by name in this Hoppers teaser, and it basically is a version of that idea, but kind of aged down. So what'd you make of this one?
This is a really cute trailer. It kind of reminded me of, weirdly, if you took all the comedic parts of The Wild Robot, a movie I absolutely love, you probably have a similar tone what's on display here, sort of blend of science fiction and environmentalism and funny talking animals. I love a good funny talking animal when it actually works, Ben. And this trailer is, it's good. I like original Pixar. I know Elio has huge problems, but I largely like it just fine. I'm hoping this one is better. I'm hoping it's a little less compromised. If you've heard the stories about how Elio is compromised, then... but I'm hoping this one's better than that. You know, Elio was a 7 out of 10. Maybe this one can hopefully be an 8 out of 10 in terms of, you know, quality of movies here. But yeah, I think this looks funny. And I like that it looks at first glance to be a straight-up Looney Tunes-style comedy. And I know that Pixar is, you know, famous these days for more nuanced storytelling and, you know, wrapping emotions into their in thematic ideas into the bigger picture. But Pixar is also really funny. They are capable of making comedies. And Hoppers looks like Pixar is making their first straight-up comedy in a long time. And I just realized it's been so long since I've laughed throughout a Pixar movie. Like, Inside Out 2, wonderful movie. But did you laugh all the way throughout it? No, you didn't. So I'm hoping Hoppers can actually be a change of pace. So, 7.5 out of 10 for this trailer.
Love that. Yeah. The only downside, I think, is I'm kind of personally getting a little tired of the character designs in Pixar movies. And maybe it's across Walt Disney Animation as well. The kind of like really rounded faces and all of that. It just kind of, there's like a sameness there that I wish they would kind of mix things up on the visual style a little bit and do something a little bit different. But I think the director of Luca is working on a movie set in Venice, the city in Italy, and it's supposed to be like hand-painted or like watercolors or something. There's some sort of stylistic departure in that movie. So at least maybe that will give me a little bit more of what I'm looking for. I think that movie is about a cat. So yeah, maybe there won't be that much of a human component there. Okay, last trailer, Jacob. Predator Badlands. I didn't even watch this one because I'm so in on this movie and I don't even need to see a single frame of what's going on to know that I'm going to at least check it out in theaters. So what do you think about this trailer?
This is an awesome trailer. I mean, Dan Trachtenberg is I know he's been taking his time between movies, you know, but every time he steps to the plate, he just knocks out of the park. Sorry for the tortured baseball metaphors on a movie podcast. I'm sorry. But this trailer rules, and I don't want to say too much because when you haven't watched it, Ben, but there are moments in this trailer that made me kind of gasp a little because I realized oh, that's where they're going with this. And all I'll say is that this really does look like a Predator movie where, one, the Predator is the main character. Two, it seems to have a more fantasy quest vibe going on for the main storyline. It sort of has hard sci-fi invading around the edges. So yeah, I did not expect to see a Predator movie that looks and feels like this. And I am very excited by what this trailer is bringing down. More so about what's... Some people are rightfully very excited about the Easter eggs of this trailer that clearly linked this to a larger part of the Alien universe, which Trachtenberg seems, very happy to indulge. But I'm more excited by what's different and unique about this trailer, specifically showing us sides of the Predator alien culture that we haven't seen before on the big screen. So yeah, this is a 9 out of 10 trailer. I'll be there opening day.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm bookmarking this to watch it after I get a chance to see the film. So that concludes this segment. And we are now joined by Slash Film editor Brad Oman to talk about the Fantastic Four First Steps. How's it going, Brad?
Hey, that's me. I'm here to talk about Fantastic Four.
Okay, so let's do a spoiler-free reaction before we really kick things off and get into the details. Jacob, what did you think about Fantastic Four First Steps?
I really, really like it. Love, kind of fluctuating between really like and love, depending on what part of the movie I'm thinking about. But yeah, this is, man, I had a great time. It's less than 2 hours. It has no baggage to it. I like the characters. I think it's a refreshing change of pace from lots that we've seen recently. And yeah, that's just my broadest possible overview of a movie that I was surprised how much it clicked for me.
Okay, Brad, what'd you think?
I think this movie is decent, but not great. Ultimately, I think there's 2/3 of a great movie here, and the third act is where it kind of starts to fall apart. I love the production design and the world that they built for the Fantastic Four in the universe in which they exist. And I love the character dynamics and how they exist within the world that they have. But ultimately, it has a really big villain problem that really comes to light at the back end of the movie, and it never really quite comes together with a really clumsy third act.
I think I largely agree with you, Brad. But before we get into specifics, I also agree that the main cast here is really, really solid. I wish there would have been more Ben Grimm in the movie, because he's the one that I feel like gets sidelined the most, and he has maybe the most interesting psychology of any of the characters here, because he has been fully transformed in a way that it seems like it's not possible to transform him back. And what does he think about that? What, we get that little bit with Natasha Lyonne's character where he has a conversation with her several times throughout the movie, but there's not really much of an insight into Ben Grimm as a character, I thought. But what did you guys think about that aspect, and then also, I guess, the characterizations of the four main characters here?
I'll double advocate this one for you, Ben, because after two movies of Ben Grimm moping about being a monster, I was actually kind of excited that this movie is like, oh, it's been 4 years. People like him. He likes people. He's over it. I feel like Ben Grimm stories of him being, looking in the mirror and saying, I'm a monster, are very tired at this point, at least for me. So especially after two movies of that character not quite connecting the way I think it needed to. So yeah, actually, I do think he probably does have the least amount to do in terms of actual story details. But I kind of just like that he was a giant friendly rock man. And that's what I like about the cast in general, is that it doesn't have the sort of sitcom antics of the 2005 movie. It doesn't have the everybody's tortured and in pain elements of the 2015 movie, which I really hate. These are good people who like each other, who work hard together. And I like that it doesn't feel like it needs to inject an unnecessary drama between people whose dynamic is they love each other, and it kind of begins and ends with that. And the simplicity of the dynamic and the way everybody plays that was actually really refreshing for me. So that's how I feel about it. Ben, you're wrong, but no, I'm joking.
What'd you think, Brad?
No, I feel most of the same way, and I think that what's great about it is it's not that Ben is fully comfortable with his transformation, because you do get like glimpses of that. He still has pangs of pain. There's a cool shot when he's watching the flashback footage of his human form before they took off on the mission that gave him the superpowers. And when the TV turns off, you see his reflection in the window, and he's looking like a little bit sadly reflective about like that's who he used to be. But he also still has largely accepted who he is now and has fun with it. And that scene with the kids, I think that some of that stuff unfortunately felt a little tacked on. Like, I think that maybe they realized, oh crap, we need to give a better arc to Ben Grimm in here. And because that stuff that they added with Natasha Lyonne's character and things, that kind of felt like it was done in reshoots as opposed to something that was part of the actual main movie. And I think it's fine because like it added a little bit extra, you know, emotion and dynamic for that character, but it also felt like it was kind of tacked on, and I would like to see more development and time spent with Ben Grimm for sure. But I do think overall the family dynamic is strong. I think Sue and Reed, especially just the chemistry between them and the love that you feel between them. And Vanessa Kirby, I mean, she's the MVP for sure. I'm a little torn on whether or not I like Johnny Storm. I don't think it's so much Johnny Storm as a character or even Joseph Quinn's performance, but some of the humor interplay between him and the Thing didn't quite work for me. And some of it might just be because it was all over the marketing and maybe I was tired of it by that point. But overall, I like the family dynamic between them all.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys about the humor in the movie, because when my wife and I walked out of the theater last night, we were talking about how it wasn't quite as funny as we expected for a typical Marvel movie. There wasn't really a ton of quips and jokes and stuff like that. It was much more serious, kind of straightforward, down the middle type of story. So just tonally, it was a little different than I expected on the humor front of things. So did that work for you guys? Bother you guys? Were you like relieved to not have everybody making jokes at every possible second? Like, what was your take on that, Jacob?
This movie is very earnest. And well, one of the things I like about it, I think the reason why I edge toward loving it, is that it's set in a world where people are allowed to be amazed. Like, people in the movie are amazed by things and are happy to be amazed by them. And like, thing, and they watch incredible things, you know, and get Spielberg face, which is, you know, just I'm always a sucker for that. And with that earnestness comes like a real lack of irony. And I love a lot of the Marvel movies' humor, but I think a lot of it by default, and it does go toward the snarky or the ironic, or like, you know, oh, that, like, let's kind of make fun of ourselves as we're going through it kind of tone. And Fantastic Four maybe has that once or twice, but it's always more gentle, it's always more earnest. And it's always presented in a way where, you know, it says, this is an incredible thing that's happening. Let's not act like it's not. And that means fewer jokes, fewer gags, but a lot more heart. So I do think that the humor trade-off works, because if they were constantly saying, oh, look, that was a weird thing that happened, then that would have been, you know, bad jokes at the expense of that sense of awe that I think the movie wants to instill in the characters and the people around them. So, yeah, not as funny, but I think that the charm that comes with it being so old-fashioned in appreciating that this is an amazing series of events is worth the trade-off.
Okay, any closing thoughts before we get into spoilers? Last chance for some spoiler-free observations if you guys want to throw anything out.
Fantastic score by Michael Giacchino, who, I mean, really can do no wrong. But yeah, a great score here for sure.
Yeah, I told you guys this story already on Slack. But the moment the movie was over, my wife and I turned to each other and literally said at the same time, so that was a Star Trek movie. Like, it literally has, if you are a Star Trek fan, you should go see this movie. Matt Shackman, the director, was going to make Star Trek 4 at one point, and it never came together. And I feel like the tone of the movie kind of gives an idea of what he would have done with a Trek movie, because it really is like this science fiction adventure story, first and foremost, where the characters talk about science and diplomacy and, you know, big brains trying to outthink, outmaneuver, or peacefully resolve situations before the clobbering starts. And the fact that it's set in this utopian alternate universe also helps, but there's a real Trek energy to this movie. And so even if you're not necessarily a big Marvel person, if you're a Trek fan, I think this movie would really be up your alley.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, let's get into spoilers for the Fantastic Four First Steps. So this is your last chance to fast forward, hit pause, do what you need to do. This is a movie about becoming a parent and having your entire world change and your priorities realigned, and your kid becomes the most important thing in the universe. And in this case, that is literalized. The Franklin character, this baby, is actually the most important being, maybe not in the entire universe, but certainly in the world. So what did you guys think about the Franklin of it all, how that character is incorporated into the story?
I like how it's incorporated emotionally. When I said Vanessa Kirby is the MVP, it's like largely because of the speech that she gives when she pleads with the people to understand why they're not going to give up Franklin to Galactus, which is what he wants, because Galactus apparently has come to understand that Franklin will become this super powerful cosmic kind of being who can stop Galactus from being forced to devour planets, which I don't entirely understand how or why or like what he's going to do once he actually gets the baby, which is a big problem with the third act, but we'll get to that in a second. But I think that the way that they work with the public and the way that, because the public initially they're like, no, give up that baby, what are you guys doing? And they're like, no, you don't understand, it's like we're a family, we're gonna face this together as a family. And like the emotional plea that she gives is so touching, and it works so well. And so I like what Franklin adds as an emotional core to the movie for the family. But unfortunately, as a plot device, I think it kind of falls apart in the third act, especially when it comes to the Looney Tunes level plan that genius Reed Richards has to try and trick Galactus to stop from getting the baby.
So, Jacob, I wondered how that landed for you, because you really like this movie. It sounds like you liked it way more than Brad and I did, and you appreciate the earnestness of it. And there is that aspect of that plan being so kind of straightforward and also silly at the same time. And like, really, this is the best that a genius can come up with? And the idea that they like swap the baby out way too early in the plan, and Galactus, a character who could potentially see this baby from miles and miles away and zero in on it, is not fooled by their Roadrunner antics or whatever. So how did that part of the movie work for you?
Oh yeah, Reed's plan is very silly. I members of the Slash Film team, I think including Brad, think the film gets really derailed by the third act. I think third act is simply just the weakest part of the movie, because it really does become, you know, keep away with a baby. And as Brad indicated, I don't think it's ever explicitly clear why Galactus needs Franklin in a way that's satisfying. There's some chatter about, you know, Galactus thinks that Franklin can take his place and he can rest, like almost like, you know, he's cursed to be Galactus and now Franklin can become Galactus, I think is what he wants. But it's never utilized in a way where I was like really engaged by Galactus' wants and needs. So it really comes down to, do I care about this baby? Do I care about the Fantastic Four, you know, caring about this baby? The answer there was yes. But yeah, even watching the movie, like for a guy who literally days earlier had a plan to teleport the Earth and could have pulled it off, the Silver Surfer didn't, you know, come in and sabotage it, literally trying to swap a baby bassinet in front of a space god is real silly, and it doesn't quite work. But by that point, I was bought in enough by the characters, and I do think like Vanessa Kirby like is really good here, and letting her play, you know, super-powered mom is really effective, and it allows the emotional dynamics of the family to play out in really, I thought, satisfying ways at the final action scene. But yeah, when you pause to think about it, which, yeah, I did too, Brad, it is like, Reed, really? Like, Reed has the smartest man in the Marvel Universe cannot come up with a better plan than this, and it's very funny in retrospect. I'll admit, I did not think about it during the movie. I was too swept up in the movie to care. But afterward, I'm like, oh man, yeah, Brad is right about this part of the movie for sure.
I think the reason that like I was so distracted by it too is also by the third act. It kind of feels like the wind is sucked out of Galactus's sails as a threat, because like he doesn't really feel all that menacing. Some of it is because the CG that brings him to life on Earth doesn't really look that great. And he's walking around, you know, like a kaiju basically. And it just felt like it never really had any weight to it. Like the threat didn't feel like it was palpable, other than just keeping the baby safe. And the way that they quote unquote fight Galactus wasn't anything that made for like a big third act spectacle that felt like it was worth it. And there's some really like perplexing shots in this final act too. Like there's one where like they do like a weird camera shift where like the it's on the back of Galactus as he's walking past some buildings, and it shifts to like focus on some of like debris that's falling, and it's not really clear why. It just feels really messy and kind of half baked, and I wish that they would have figured out a way to make it look better and also feel like more of a substantial threat.
Yeah, and while we're talking about things that didn't really work, Reed's superpowers, the way they're depicted in this movie, they just look so goofy and like not in a really fun way, in like a really dumb way. I thought it's almost like they're embarrassed that Reed's powers are to stretch, and they try to do it as little as possible or focus on it as little as possible. And the moment when Galactus has him in his hands and starts pulling him apart, I was like, shouldn't this not be a problem for him? Like his whole thing is being able to stretch. And so all of a sudden there's an issue with him being able to stretch too far. I don't know. I just was not really sold, or I didn't really buy into the way that they depicted his powers on screen. So that's a small thing in the grand scheme of the story of the movie, the tone of the movie, the look of the movie, all of that. But I was kind of taken out of it a little bit by that nonetheless. So I didn't know if that bothered you as well, Brad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're always going to have a problem depicting Reed's powers, because it's always going to take them to an uncanny valley place, because you can't make a person look real when their body is stretching like bubblegum and their head looks like a normal person's head. It's just, it's yeah, never going to look good. And yeah, it's tough for them to obviously make that work. I have a question for you guys. So Reed's big plan is to completely teleport the entire planet to a different universe in order to save it from Galactus, because for whatever reason, it will take him millions of years to find them somewhere else in the universe. As we see in the movie, the way the teleportation works is there's a start point and there's an end point. So how did they build the receiving end of the portal to transport Earth to another universe?
Yeah, that was weird, and they definitely skipped over that. Unless, I don't know, Jacob, did you pick up on something there that I missed?
I don't give a shit. I mean, I appreciate the fun of the conversation there, but in terms of like actual impact in the story, I accept that Reed Richards is a genius, and I accept that he found a way, because that's more important. Like that to me, like if the movie had paused to over-explain this, we're getting the Beauty and the Beast remake territory, and I don't need that. I just need to be told Reed Richards is very smart. He built this machine. Let's go.
I would agree with you to a certain extent if they didn't make such a show of how difficult and how much work was required for them to build all of the gates to teleport the Earth to begin with. Mm. Like there's a whole montage of like, hey everybody, we're gonna work together to save the Earth, and it's like
this great montage.
This is like, awesome. Yeah, it's great. But then that makes me, it's like, okay, so, but how is this working on the other end? It's just, it's a logistical point. I feel like they could have easily explained away. And it just feels like, I don't know. It's a tough thing to like accept, especially when you see, you know, how bad the other plan is.
I guess my whole thing is like, it's so much more important to me that the world works together, and this depiction of a world who says, yeah, let's do the right thing together. Let's pool our resources. Let's not fight. That to me, landing those hits is so much more important than, you know, a line saying, oh yeah, we fixed it to do this, because like that's a Star Trek of it all. It's like, you know, you work together, you utopias require work, and Fantastic Four ask a lot of the world and the world steps up. I mean everybody gets to be a hero in the end. That's freaking cool. And that to me, like I don't know, like it reminded me a lot of James Gunn and Superman from 2 weeks ago, a movie that says, do you know what's cool? Being nice and being helpful and taking care of your fellow person. And that really resonated with me here and in both films. I think both films would make kind of a remarkably good double feature. This is very much a case where I don't feel a need to get into those weeds, because the big picture works enough for me.
Yeah. See, and for me, it's just that the rest of it didn't feel like it was quite good enough to overshadow thinking of some of the logistical things. However, I will say, one thing that I did appreciate in favor of the plot as far as them building the gates all over the world is I was genuinely floored when Silver Surfer showed up and started destroying the portals, because it felt like the third act was legitimately going to work and would take place in a different universe. And so when she showed up and started just blowing things up, I was just like, holy shit, what?
Yeah, and maybe, Brad, to give the movie a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, maybe there's something on a blackboard somewhere that explains, you know, in the background of one of these shots that kind of explains away how the teleportation would have worked on the other side, that like maybe people will zoom in and figure out once the movie comes on home video or something. But Jacob, yeah,
it's right next to the diagram that says Acme's plan to save Franklin.
Jacob, you brought up a couple things that I had written down. Like, the biggest reason I could tell this film is fiction is not because of the stretchy man or the orange rock dude. It's because when an existential terror threatens to wipe out the planet, the scientific experts ask humanity to come together to make sacrifices for the betterment of everyone, and everyone actually does it. So it seems like two weeks ago,
a newspaper report written by Lois Lane stopped Lex Luthor. So I'm enjoying these superhero fantasies more often, where newspapers and journalism still works, and where scientists are listened to. Isn't it a great fantasy? Yeah.
It really is. Like, Earth 828 has figured something out that we haven't. And then, yeah, the James Gunn Superman thing, I thought of like a couple different parallels. Like, Superman begins with that info about like 300 years ago, 3 years ago, 3 minutes ago. And then Fantastic Four First Steps begins with like a 4 years ago montage catching us up on their exploits. And then I think more potently, the idea that Brad alluded to earlier, like the idea of how large groups respond to the actions of the heroes in question. And in Superman, the world seems to turn against him when things get tough. And the same thing happens here when people realize that Galactus would spare the planet if he gets Franklin. So I definitely think it would be a really interesting double feature, because I think Superman is a much more like a overtly political movie that has more on its mind than this film does. It's a little bit more of an insular story about parenthood and stuff. But yeah, just some of the same plot beats or reflections of plot beats popping up in both movies. It was just an interesting thing, considering they are two major movies, superhero movies from rival companies, and they're both incredibly important to the future of their respective cinematic universes. So yeah, just some fun stuff there. What do you guys think about Mole Man, Paul Walter Hauser showing up as Mole Man, and the idea of Subterranea?
Oh my gosh, I love Mole Man so much. I love Paul Walter Hauser in this role. And seeing him and how he interacts with the Fantastic Four made me wish that he was the villain of this movie instead. Because I think, along with the third act issues, that maybe my biggest complaint about this movie is it feels like it's trying to do so many big things for the first MCU outing for the Fantastic Four. And as much as I appreciate them establishing Fantastic Four already existing for several years before this movie happens, I think I would have much rather preferred a villain that felt more on a ground level and wasn't so big and hard to get a grasp on for them to deal with. And so seeing just the quirky performance that Paul Walter Hauser has as Mole Man and the way he interacts with the team, especially like the way he jabs at Johnny and stuff like that, I would have loved to have seen what it would have been like for him to be the primary villain of the movie instead.
What do you think, Jacob?
I love his performance, but I love that he's a frenemy. I love that they clashed, they talked it out and said, yeah, you have your underground kingdom, it's cool. And I love that the dynamic is less hero and villain and more like neighbors who disagree on who has to fix the fence. So one of the main things I love this movie is that it's a science fiction adventure. There is superheroics in it. There is a great deal of action. But ultimately, the Fantastic Four, at their best in the comics, and why I love them so much, has been that they're explorers and scientists first, and then if they need to punch things, they'll punch things. And Mole Man is definitely a villain that they would need to punch. So I kind of love that off screen, before this movie started, they reasoned with him and through diplomacy worked out a deal. I wish there was more of him, but also I'm glad that Fantastic Four were given a full-on science fiction adventure villain threat, so they can go into space and be explorers and adventurers and Star Trek it up, because I'm very, very happy with Mole Man just being the guy who lives beneath them and wears silly glasses and likes Sue but does not like Reed, which is a fun little detail that I think speaks volumes about their dynamic. I want to see the Marvel short film that explores the negotiations that led to all of this, because I found what's not said to be very entertaining.
Yeah. I think, Jacob, your willingness to kind of hand wave away the logistics of the teleportation of the planet, I felt that same willingness to just buy into the world of Subterranea and Mole Man's whole deal. Like the idea of an under the surface world that's big enough to house the entirety of New York City is ludicrous. And the movie does not really go out of its way to explain how that works or really give us much of a look into what Subterranea even looks like. But I think because you've got Paul Walter Hauser as the ostensible leader of that community, and he just brings such a levity to the movie and an attitude and a performance and a perspective, it just feels like, okay, I'm on board. I understand this person. So therefore I'm on board with whatever the movie is asking me to buy into regarding what he represents. So yeah, just a little bit of a difference of how they treated certain aspects of the movie. So yeah, any closing thoughts on this movie? Anything we didn't really get to yet?
I just think it's neat. I mean, to use the Marge Simpson's meme, I think this movie it really holds up. I like there's no fat on it. It's 118 minutes and it flies. It just jumps into the story. It trusts you to pick up on character context, to performance, instead of like long like the Jurassic World Rebirth problem of characters sitting on a boat and talking back to each other is not here, because the movie lets the characters grow through their interactions and through like moments, as opposed to like info dumps. Even the opening montage of like their past stuff doesn't feel like I'm being info dumped. I just like that it just feels like its own damn thing, and it has no interest in, you know, building out the larger Marvel universe, which became the Marvel universe's like, you know, problem after a while. I was so gung-ho about all the connections and Easter eggs and setups early on, but it started weighing down the movies so badly over the past 5 years, whereas this one just wants to be its own thing. It wants to do this one thing really well. And when the text appears in the credits saying the Fantastic Four will return in Avengers Doomsday, my first thought was, oh man, I was so thrilled by them having their own little world that I was actually, me, a former diehard MCU fan who's learning to love again, like having a stomach pain, like a little stomach ache over these characters suddenly being shoved into a giant crossover when I want to see this world breathe some more. So I'm going to enjoy this while I can. I'm going to enjoy this, the first good Fantastic Four movie while I can.
I forgot to mention the mid-credits scene, which is Dr. Doom showing up and in the apartment and coming face-to-face with Franklin. And that's basically all we get. Were you guys pleased with that? Did that feel like an exciting way to lead into the next movie? Because I think Doomsday is the next film that's going to be released, right? I don't think there's anything
in between. It is. And if the scene had teased, oh, Fantastic Four versus Dr. Doom, great. Dr. Doom's my favorite supervillain in all of comic books. Let's do it. But instead it's teasing Dr. Doom versus 38 Avengers and X-Men actors. And I'm like, I'm less excited for that than I would have been if it was just teasing, you know, hey, Fantastic Four 2 will be, you know, Doom centric. I don't know. I liked this little world enough that I would have loved to see Doom introduced on a smaller scale before he starts fighting Spider-Man.
Actually, it looks like Spider-Man Brand New Day comes out before Avengers.
Oh, Doom. Really?
Yeah. Okay. That's currently slated for July 31st, 2026, and Doomsday got pushed to December 18th, 2026. So,
okay. Gotcha. Well, yeah. What'd you think about that mid-credit scene, Brad? Any thoughts there? I mean, there's not much to it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I thought it was fine. Like, it was basically what I would have expected a mid-credit scene to be, is just like Doom showing up and being like, oh, here he comes. You know, it establishes that the plot of Doomsday will likely begin in the Fantastic Four's universe. And yeah, I mean, I guess I'm curious, but I don't know. Yeah, things have been so touch and go lately, and I just don't know. I'm hopeful that they can bring it all together. I'm excited about the prospect of seeing what feels like will be X-Men versus Avengers, with Doom being the puppet master behind it all. But yeah, I don't know. I'm cautiously optimistic. I liked but did not love Fantastic Four, you know. But yeah, we'll see.
I feel the same way. I just want to wrap up with a quick, it's not even a lightning round, it's just a one or the other question. Did you guys prefer Thunderbolts more than Fantastic Four First Steps, or the other way around? I preferred Thunderbolts, I think. Brad, what about you?
Yes, I prefer Thunderbolts and I prefer Superman.
Okay, Jacob?
Man, these are my two favorite Marvel movies in literally years, so it's really tough for me to say. I think I'd give the edge to Thunderbolts because I think it's more thematically bold. in its third act. Like, the best part of Thunderbolts is its third act, whereas the weakest part of Fantastic Four is its third act. So Thunderbolts ending strong, I think, gives it the edge, even though I genuinely think that both these showcase a Marvel I can care about again, and one that I'm very worried that it's being handed back to the Russos for a very Hail Mary Avengers movie right after this.
Okay, I lied. One more question. We're recording this on Friday, and I just wonder how you guys think this movie is going to perform. Do you think, we don't have to get into like guessing down to the million or whatever for its opening weekend at the box office, but just broadly speaking, do you think this movie is going to be successful enough for Kevin Feige and the folks at Marvel to feel good about all the attention that they have heaped on this movie and like sort of positioning this as a key pillar in the Marvel Cinematic Universe going forward? Do you think the movie will do well enough for them to feel good about that decision?
I mean, I hope so, because the MCU needs a dad. Like, this is my wife's observation. I'm going to steal it directly. But she says, one of her big issues is since Endgame, all the people who felt like they could be the dad in a given Marvel situation have all vanished. Everybody's left are like characters who can't take, who are either ineffective leaders or can't be bought as leaders. And I think Pedro Pascal, we haven't talked about him much during this conversation. His Reed Richards is the kind of guy who I can imagine stepping into a room full of superheroes and saying, okay, eyes on me, let's move this plot forward in a way that I don't think, you know, Captain America 2, Sam Wilson can do. So this is, I really hope this does well, because I would like Marvel to have faith in this cast to be, you know, I think the character-driven cornerstone that they haven't had since Steve Rogers went through that portal and vanished.
What do you think, Brad?
No, I think it's going to do well. I mean, the Thursday number is already out there, and it's the biggest Thursday preview of the year so far. It looks like it's going to be beat Superman, and just the Thursday alone, I think, is enough to beat the entire opening weekend of 2015's Fantastic Four. So, yeah, it looks like it'll do well, and I'm glad that it will, because I do like the cast, and I would like to see another Fantastic Four movie. But yeah, so I'm even though I am lukewarm on the movie and maybe didn't like it as much as some of the other people, I would definitely like to see, you know, this team back together again.
Cool. All right. Well, Jacob is going to leave us now, and Brad is going to stick around and tell me about Happy Gilmore 2. Before we get into the sequel, Brad, I want to know where Happy Gilmore stands for you. I know you're a big Adam Sandler fan.
Well, let's reel that back in a little bit. I'm a big fan of Adam Sandler, let's say pre-2005, and then his dramatic work since then.
Okay, yeah. It definitely needs qualifying, considering the type of stuff he's been making over the
and
past
his several
stand years.
His stand-up specials have been surprisingly great in recent years as well, so I will give him that.
Okay, well, I know you like sports movies on occasion, so
yes.
Does Happy Gilmore qualify as like a big deal movie for you when you're a kid?
100%. I talk about this a little bit in my interview with Happy Gilmore 2 director Kyle Newacek. Happy Gilmore, I very distinctly remember where I was when I saw it. Whenever we would go to my aunt and uncle's house in Illinois, we would pretty much always go rent a movie. Sometimes I would be in on what was being rented, other times I wouldn't. Happy Gilmore, I had no idea what this movie was or anything. They put it on and we watched it in their living room. And it's one of the hardest times I've ever laughed as a kid at a movie. I was rolling while I was watching this movie. I remember it so well. There were so many things that just cracked me up to the point where that's like, even my dad was like, okay, calm down. but it was, yeah, this movie was one of my favorite movies that I watched when I was a kid, and I watched over and over. After that, it's still one of my favorite Adam Sandler comedies. I love Happy Gilmore. And it's a great comedy. It's a great sports movie. Yeah, absolutely.
Was that your first Adam Sandler film, or did it just hit you in the right way?
I'm pretty sure that was my first Adam Sandler movie. And it would have been right around the time that it had just come out on video. So probably, you know, late 1996 or 1997, probably at the latest.
Okay.
But yeah, because I hadn't seen Billy Madison yet, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And Wedding Singer wouldn't come out until like a year later. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that was my first proper Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah, there was something about Chris and I did an episode a while back talking a lot about Adam Sandler's work, and I don't remember why, but at the time when we were kids, he was never really one of my guys. I think I came to him a little bit later. I saw some of these movies, and Happy Gilmore was one that I saw pretty early because my dad used to play golf professionally. So, I had a connection to like this and Caddyshack and things like that, you know, any sort of golf movie. And there weren't and still aren't very many golf related films. But you would think that because of that connection, and because I grew up in the right age bracket for this movie to really hit me in the right way, that it would have been in my rotation a lot growing up. And it just really wasn't. I think I've only seen it maybe twice or something in my whole life. So, it was just never really like a huge deal for me. But there are so many moments from it that I remember and that stand out and that have kind of like elevated beyond just that like goofy 90s class of comedies into, I would say, iconic moments. Like the Bob Barker fight in that movie, I would put icon status on that scene. You know?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's the best thing about it is like it's not only, I mean, it's very uniquely an Adam Sandler movie at this time in his career, but it also fits perfectly into that classic comedy framework of slobs versus snobs. Is, you know, it's the same thing that makes Caddyshack work. It's the same thing that makes Animal House work. You know, it's a good formula, and Adam Sandler just fits perfectly in it.
Yeah. And the Shooter McGavin of it all, like anytime I would actually play golf, which is not very often, I maybe play golf like once a year or something. And especially when I was younger, when I would be like playing with my friends in high school or something like that, the Shooter McGavin isms would get busted out on the golf course all the time. So, yeah, that brings us to Happy Gilmore 2, which, do you remember what your initial reaction was when they announced that they were finally making this movie? Because I think it was kind of like rumored or like discussed for a long time anyway. And then 2025. I mean, it's been a long time since that first film.
Yeah, oh, it's been almost 30 years. And I remember thinking that, first of all, it was surprising. I couldn't believe they were actually finally circling back to it after all these years. And then also just kind of immediate worry, because unfortunately, for the most part, Adam Sandler's cinematic comedic output has been pretty much overall disappointing. If he's not doing some kind of dramatic movie, then it's usually not turning out very great. And that's especially true for pretty much all the movies he's done for Netflix, save for one or two that have some redeeming qualities. But yeah, it's, so I was very trepidatious. You know, I always want a movie to be good. I never hope that a movie is going to be bad. And yeah, so this was very, a worrisome concept, but one that I hoped would have some potential. You know, something, if something could get Adam Sandler kind of back into, you know, a place that felt good, like the old Adam Sandler, maybe Happy Gilmore 2 could do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said before that comedy sequels are just incredibly hard to pull off. And I guess this is a long-winded wind-up to what we're getting to here, which is, I've not had a chance to see Happy Gilmore 2 yet, but I saw your reaction to it on Slack, and I'm hoping you can tell me what you thought about the movie, and we'll just go from there. What'd you think about this one?
Yeah, it brings me no joy whatsoever to say that Happy Gilmore 2 is awful. It is just downright bad. It is so stuffed full of shoehorned throwbacks to the original movie and the kind of jokes where they want to make sure that you know what they're referencing. So if by some miracle you haven't seen Happy Gilmore, or you don't remember a certain bit that they're referencing or a certain character that's coming back or anything, they literally do over a dozen flashbacks to the scene in the original movie to make sure that you understand what's happening. And that's just the beginning.
No.
Yeah. It's a real fucking, like, they think that you're the dumbest person on the planet. And that's just the beginning of the problems. This movie is so much bigger than Happy Gilmore in a way that is so misguided. It feels more like a Dodgeball sequel than it does a Happy Gilmore sequel. It's big and vibrant and cartoonish, and it just does not tap into what made the original Happy Gilmore good. Like I can't, there are so many things, like, I can't even get a grasp on how unfortunate the direction of this movie was as far as the narrative is concerned. It's like if you took, you know, Grown Ups mixed it with Dodgeball and then threw Happy Gilmore into the mix, because the premise is that there's this new maxi golf league that Benny Safdie's character is trying to start. And apparently this is, I learned from a friend of mine who follows golf and stuff like that, this is similar to a real life thing that happened where outside of the PGA, there was a different golf tour organization that tried to organize and change things up a little bit. But the Maxi Golf League is like the, what the XFL was to the NFL, but even more ridiculous. Like, it's insane golf kind of stuff, like where the rules are ridiculous, the courses have like stupid obstacles on them, and like it doesn't even feel like golf. And so Happy and a whole crew of real life professional golfers are against it because it goes against the sanctity of golf, which is it's kind of an interesting idea to put Happy Gilmore, who was once the rebel of classic golf, in the position to save what is, you know, great about classic golf. But the movie doesn't ever really capitalize on like that the interesting like angle that you know means for a character like that. Like there's a quick comment on it, but it's nothing more thoughtful than that. You know, it's just a passing thing because the movie is so obsessed with professional golf cameos and other cameos as well as references to the original movie that it kind of forgot that it's also supposed to be funny. There are some moments of laughter here and there. There's some good lines from characters and funny moments, but man, this movie is trying so hard to be like this big evolution of like Happy Gilmore, and it just did not need to be this at all. It's embarrassing in a lot of ways. It's truly embarrassing.
Man, that is really unfortunate. And it sounds like there's such an interesting idea like baked into the foundation of the story, because I don't know much about it, and I'm sorry if I get any of the details wrong, but I think there's a separate league and they're like backed by Saudi money in real life, and like there's a big controversy in the world of golf about this, and it sounds like the movie is like kind of taking aim at that or like trying to comment on that maybe in a funny way, but it sounds like it just kind of gets sidelined by I'm still like, my mind is reeling at the idea that they show you flashbacks to the original movie. That is like, you don't do that in a comedy. You, like, there are not very many rules that you should abide by in Hollywood movies, I think, you know, especially comedic things. Like, part of the humor is in breaking the rules. But man, just showing, slowing the movie down to nothing and then flashing back and then making another joke just sounds like one of the worst things ever. That sounds terrible.
It is. It's really bad. yeah, it's really, really bad. It became like a groan inducing eye rolling moment every time it would happen. And I couldn't believe it was something that they just kept doing over and over again. And like, it's one of those things too, where like every single character who was in the first movie, especially those who aren't around anymore, have some kind of successor who takes on the role, whether it's somebody's, you know, son, like Chubbs's son is in this movie, played by Lavelle Crawford, the son of Mr. Larson, Happy's old boss, played by the actor who played Jaws in the James Bond movies. I'm forgetting his name right now.
So. Oh yeah, Richard Kiel, I think.
Yes, yeah. His son is a minor character in the movie. Eminem's character is the son of another character from the first movie. It's just so much of like moving pieces. Like really, all these people are just doing the exact same things that their parents were after 30 years. And this is the best we could come up with for their characters, is just basically just do the same things over again. One of the best things about the original movie was that dynamic that existed between Happy Gilmore and Shooter McGavin, just great rivals. And without spoiling anything, I'll just say that is completely squandered in this movie.
Man, that is unfortunate. So I'm trying to think of comedy sequels that have really done it right. And I'm thinking of like
22 Spider-Man Jump Street.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great one. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And like both of those movies that we just mentioned have more narrative thrust than the kind of like premise-based comedies of like the early Sandler years and stuff like that. Maybe Ghostbusters 2, I guess you could argue, like some people kind of quibble over the quality of that, and it's certainly a step down from the first one, but like Ghostbusters 2 is watchable, you know.
Yeah.
Are there any other older comedies that you can think of that got sequels that weren't straight up embarrassing?
Adam's Family Values might actually be better than the original Adam's Family.
That's a perfect one, yeah.
Wayne's World 2, I think, is still fantastic.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea of one that, or a good example of one that is like, that probably shouldn't have worked as well as it did, especially with all the behind-the-scenes stuff that was going on with like the making of that movie and how everything, like the original plan was scrapped like pretty close to them actually shooting it and all that. So they kind of pulled out of a tailspin with that one, but...
This is a little easier to do because like the premise that it's based on was meant to be sequelized as well, but the Austin Powers sequels I think did it very well. People were kind of done with the shtick by the time Goldmember came around, but The Spy Who Shagged Me is a great comedy sequel.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I'm glad that some of them exist and can actually pull this off, but it just seems so rare. There are so many more
and
comedy
even
sequels
there
that
are,
don't work.
There are even some that like repeat the basic premise of the original movie with some slight changes to work. Like I actually really enjoy Neighbors 2 Sorority Rising, despite the fact that it's very similar to the original. It still has a funny script though, and you like the characters in it, so it works.
Yeah, the Hangover movies I was thinking of, and they basically repeat the same thing, and I think to like extremely
much to their
diminishing
detriment.
Yeah, diminishing returns. So yeah, I guess, is there anything else you wanted to say about Happy Gilmore 2 before we jump into your interview?
No, you know, everyone will have to just see it for themselves, maybe I'm being a grump. I don't think so though. And I just think that, like, yeah, when people get to see what this is, they'll be like, this doesn't feel like a Happy Gilmore sequel. It just feels, something about it feels completely off. I'm a professional, so I have a very good talk with Kyle Newcheck, and I talked to him about the things that I thought were interesting, and you know, asking about the making of it. When we get into spoiler territory, I talk about, you know, the things that are big swings in this movie. And, actually there's one thing that happens that I don't know if we want to, well, this is going to come out after the movie comes out. Right. But I don't know if I want to spoil it for you though.
Oh, it's okay. Go ahead. It sounds like, it's going to be a long time before I catch up with Happy Gilmore 2.
Yeah. So this is the one thing that happens and that the movie never really recovers from. And it happens early on because it's the basis for like where we find Happy in the movie. And it's that Virginia Vennett dies. It's not just that she dies though. It's that she dies because a drive hit by Happy Gilmore kills her.
Wow.
And that's what sends him into his downward spiral. And he loses the grandma's house and leaves golf forever. And now he can't afford to send his daughter, played by his real daughter, to this fancy ballet school that she's going to get into in Paris. And so that's what gets him back into golf. And he sees visions of Virginia, like in his happy place, and stuff that like encourages him. But it's such a big, dark thing that happens. And I talked to Kyle about this. And his reasoning makes sense because if you think about the original Happy Gilmore, in the opening credits, they very casually do away with Happy's dad. He just suddenly dies during that opening montage. He's killed by getting hit by a hockey puck. And it's played for laughs, even though it's a sad thing. But there's just something about Happy being the one that killed Virginia himself and just how it kind of comes out of nowhere. It's just like, wow. And every time like they talk about it, all you can do is think about how your jaw dropped when you saw it happen. When it plays out in the movie, like I was just like, what are we doing here? Because I was already prepared myself that Virginia was going to die because I made this guess based on the trailer. I even wrote an article about, I was like, I'm pretty sure she's dead in this movie. So I was expecting that. I was not expecting it to take that route. And I was just floored. And yeah, the movie never really fully recovers from it. So yeah, that's tough. But I talked to Kyle about that. Talked to Kyle about some other interesting things. You know, there's plenty of good stuff to talk about, just to learn about, and you know, ask how it was working with like Eminem, and you know, the challenge of working with someone like Adam Sandler and stuff like that. So yeah, at the very least, it was a good conversation that we had.
Cool. All right. Well, here is Brad's conversation with Happy Gilmore 2 director Kyle Newacek.
So to begin with, let's go back in time. Do you remember the first time you saw Happy Gilmore?
I remember my feeling. I don't remember if it was, I'm assuming it was in the theater, but I might have had to wait till it was at Blockbuster. I don't know if my mom would have like taken me to see that at that time. I think it was a Blockbuster rental, dude.
Yeah.
And then I think it was probably me and my brother watching it, who's a couple years younger than me and a couple of my friends. I was 12 or 11, I guess, when the movie came out, like 11 or 12. And so I just remember somewhere in the recesses of my brain watching that movie, and Billy Madison had already come out. And so I just remember connecting in my head, like, wait, how is this being made? You know, like for the first time thinking like, how that guy's the same guy that was in the other one. And that's the same guy that was in the other one. So they're just having fun. And I had gotten into like some theater at that age and was starting to perform in front of people. So it was really informative for me in terms of getting me on the path of actually making movies. I had and so I think it was probably, I could, within the year, probably 6 months, I was out there with a camera filming my friends doing improv, trying to make something as funny as Happy Gilmore.
Yeah, that's really cool. So were you not familiar with Adam Sandler on Saturday Night Live at the time then or anything?
No, I mean, I knew about all of that. Like I was starting to get into improv. So my mom had showed me like old SNL.
Okay.
Like from her time period. And then, yes, I think right after this, I kind of went right after Happy Gilmore, I started digging further into the SNL world and being like, wait, what? So he's also doing this. What's going on? You know,
that's really cool. Yeah, because I'm kind of in this same boat where my aunt and uncle rented Happy Gilmore when I was a kid, and so I didn't see it in theaters. And I just remember laughing some of the hardest times I ever did when I was a kid watching that movie.
Oh my gosh! And he spoke to me as a frustrated, like angry 12-year-old hitting, you know, those like with brotherhood and fighting and all that. Like he really spoke to us. Like he was aggro, and so were we. And he, like him getting hit in the batting cage, like just to toughen up, is crazy cool. Like it was crazy cool to watch back then. You're like, this guy is tough and he's funny. How is this possible?
So you worked with Adam Sandler before this on Murder Mystery, but had you encountered him at all before that? Were there ever interaction that you had with him before you were able to actually work with him?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. First time I met him, we were working together.
Gotcha. So what's the collaborative process like with someone like Adam Sandler, who has such a distinctive comedic footprint?
I think in this one, it was very much zeroing in on that distinctive comedic footprint. And most importantly, like how does this represent the authentic performer and creator that is Adam Sandler? Because his body of work now, since 1996, goes in a full circle. Like he's touched everything. So with this movie, thankfully they found a script that worked really well and a subject matter that he could really play into and play the depth, while still having that absurdist take on the other side and that absurdist humor supporting and balancing the tragedy that is at the core of the film, you know.
Right.
There's not many people that can that are that well rounded, and there's probably a lot of people that can do it, but not a lot of people that there's not a lot of people that can do it. And yeah. There's not a lot of people that the audiences would accept doing it either.
For sure.
You know, he's earned that.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is one of his, Happy Gilmore is one of his most beloved movies. So, I mean, making a sequel just on its own is a tall order. So, but besides trying to like please the fans and follow up what is a movie that is just, you know, so, so beloved, what was the biggest challenge while making this movie?
I think the biggest challenge was, I mean, it happened fast.
Yeah.
It happened fast. We were in it and going. So a lot of it was like reactive, kind of.
How long was the shoot?
We shot for like 60 days, but okay. The prep was really quick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. I think let me see here. The biggest challenge on this movie was it could have been handling all of the guests coming in, you know, and then also shooting golf was hard. Like getting out there and just like going on these golf courses, like you have to move all over the place. We had the whole production was on golf carts moving around like seamlessly, like yeah. from hole to hole to hole. It felt like we were in Mad Max. Like a lot of times when we were shooting the movie on the golf courses, that's what I said, we're in Mad Max mode again.
Yeah.
Because it just was crazy. Everybody had their like their carts with like their water connected to it and then their batteries and then they got their shade. It's like we're camping out there. It was pretty rad.
I'm glad you mentioned the challenge of wrangling so many different talents, because you've got this plethora of real professional golfers. You've got other athletes like Travis Kelce. You have an established filmmaker like Benny Safdie, seasoned comedic talents like Sandler and Ben Stiller. Actors like Haley Joel Osment, Margaret Qualley, and even Eminem, just to throw another challenge in there. So, like, did you find yourself having to adapt your directing style to, like, accommodate so many different people to, like, get, you know, what you wanted out of them?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because everybody who comes in has their own energy. You know, they have their own thoughts about what it's going to be, and they have their own kind of ideas of what it could be, and you know, everything, their own egos and all that, you know. But what was cool about this is people kind of just like myself, when you hear about it and you hear you're going to set, you come in with a willingness to like whatever it takes.
Yeah,
I just want this to be good. I want to be a part of something that's awesome. And I'm kind of used to working with a lot of different people. I've had big casts before. The weird thing about this is it was like a big cast for like, you'd have somebody come in for one day.
Right.
And you just have to really get the best you can out of them. And then bye. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the scenes, I mean, geez, there's a scene in the middle of the movie when they're at the championship dinner, which is like all the golfers. You got Jack Nicklaus, Fred Couples, Lee Trevino, Sir Nick Faldo, Xander, Jordan Spieth, you know, Ricky Fowler, Colin, Morikawa, Bradley, Bad Bunny, and then Travis Kelce, and then Adam Sandler. And you're like, all right, all these guys are in a room. We're all doing this. This is wild.
Yeah.
I just remember on that day, I feel like I took my shoes off and was just walking around like in my socks, just like getting as close to the action as I could so that I'm there.
Yeah.
If anybody needs anything, I'm there, you know, with an idea.
Looking closer, I wanted to talk about Eminem, because between this and his appearances and stuff like Funny People and the interview, it seems like he just has such a natural comedic ability, you know, and that's something that comes through in his rap albums too. What's it like working with him?
He's great. He's great. He's wonderful. He, you know, we had him in a pretty precarious situation. We brought him in and it was like, okay, now you're going to do this. And now you're going to pretend that this is happening. And it was not easy to do what we had him doing.
Right.
And so we, he went in the water and then he did his thing, and then we were like, this is good. We got it. This is beautiful. Thank you. We had one day with him, and then he came back to the monitors and kind of watched playback and was like, you know what? I got some other ideas. I'm gonna go back in that precarious situation and try it again.
Oh,
So
nice.
again, it's a craftsman,
Yeah.
M's always had the irony and the wit. That's not surprising that he's got wit and understands humor, because his first albums and all of his albums really, but his first ones were very, very witty.
Yeah,
Like
absolutely.
he's, when you have that tongue, you got some skills.
Yeah, for sure. So,
That's a weird thing to say, but I said
yeah. So
it.
there's tons of people in this movie. Was there anybody that you wanted to get in that didn't work out, whether because of scheduling or anything like that?
No.
Oh,
I
that's
mean,
great.
I think we were very happy with everybody that we got, and everybody who showed up was very ready and willing, and I would not wish it any other way.
That's great. Now, do you find that it's difficult to get comedies made in today's landscape? Just because it feels like the big studios, they're not doing big theatrical comedies anymore. It feels like it's shifted to streaming and television. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I feel like there's a big hole out there. I feel like it's problematic. I feel like it's an issue,
Yeah.
because we as a people used to have like comedies that we could gather around and chat about, And I'm talking real laugh-em-ups,
Yeah.
like real comedies, not the cerebral pseudo comedy that also has incredible dramatic performances. I'm talking about the actual comedy that has like one or two dramatic scenes in it for a moment, but there's also a big joke. Like I'm like real comedies, and I don't know where they went. I
Yeah.
don't know what happened. I mean, yes, there's nothing in the theater.
Right.
There's nothing in the theater.
Yeah, like the only real like big comedy coming out this summer is The Naked Gun, and that's not even until August.
Well, that's the only one.
Yeah.
But I do believe that to be a good sign. I hope that it works,
Same.
And I really do. I also hope that critics and people can let go a little bit and maybe stop judging comedy so hard, like real comedy. Because I think comedy is something that you can kind of take for granted.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of them, so much so that I feel like a lot of people were like, yeah, this comedy is not good enough. But now when you look back at that comedy, you're like, that was great.
Right.
It served its purpose. It made me th not think about my crazy life for 2 hours. That's the purpose.
Yeah.
It's an escape. It's
Absolutely.
laughter. It's a communal laughter.
Did you ever try to convince Netflix to give Happy Gilmore 2 a theatrical release?
Well, I've tried to convince Netflix every one of my movies to put it in the movie theater instead, because I think it's cooler. But
Yeah.
I just like when I make the movies, we get to watch it in a theater in front
Right.
of people. So I've seen this. I've watched a big theater watch this movie, and it works.
That's great.
And I just wish that more people got that experience.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. All right, so I'm going to dig into full spoiler territory. This is not going to come out until after the movie, so you can talk openly and we're not going to ruin anything before the movie comes out.
Okay, is that real?
That's
Have they pulled
100%
it?
real. Yeah, all we're it's it will we will hold that back until after the movie comes out. All
Okay.
right, so there's no other way to say this, but Virginia Vennett gets killed very early in the movie, and it's the driving force of the entire movie. Was there ever any concern about not being able to bounce back from such a dark, dramatic twist?
Yeah, I guess there's a concern. There's always a concern when you're playing with that type of darkness, but I don't know. I was never really concerned, because it is the driving force. If you pull that out, then what do you have?
Yeah.
You don't have anything real. But yeah, when I first read the screenplay, that's like page 5, and I was like, glued
Yeah,
when
it's
that
like it's
happened.
jaw dropping.
So I knew what that feeling felt like, and I knew that people could get over it. You can get over it. You
Yeah.
can't, and it's not far away from the fabric of the world, because in the first one, his father dies
Right.
and he gets sent. That's tragic.
Yeah.
His mother moves to Egypt, and then his father dies, and then he moves in with grandma,
Yeah.
you know? So it is, there's been darkness in this. There's darkness in the first one. There's real dark humor. So I just felt it fitting.
Yeah, that's fair. Now, Shooter and Happy get to go at it again, but ultimately they end up working together. Was there ever a point in development where they didn't make amends and they stayed rivals, or was that like an important thing to like develop that relationship and change the dynamic?
I'm not sure about the early iterations of the screenplay, because I just kind of read the one that we were going to go to work on.
Gotcha.
So as far as I know, it always Shooter always became Noble.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, and I like that. I like the Noble Shooter is a good moment for me. I think
Yeah.
it's pretty sweet.
Also, speaking of, we're talking about dark stuff too. It's kind of both sad and funny for like the fight in the graveyard where we see all the different gravestones of the characters who have died over the years, because sadly we've lost them in real life as well.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's kind of what you're dealing with. I think that it, I also think that sometimes when you're dealing with tragedy like that, you know, it makes the laughs feel better.
For sure.
So there's that. But I mean, that was important. That was important to honor everyone from the first one who couldn't
Yeah.
make it
Now,
out on this one.
Happy's caddy comes back for this movie, but he's played by Will Zalatoris, which is a fun twist to make that character
Oh
professional golfer. But
yeah.
was there ever any attempt to get Jared Van Snellenberg back from the original movie to reprise that role?
I think as soon as, because the real golfing world kind of dragged Zalatoris saying this is the caddy from the original. So there was a pop culture thing that happened with Zalatoris.
Yeah.
And so I think that it just became humorous to to follow that in a very real way.
Yeah. That's funny. Now, obviously, the big event in the movie is the Maxi tournament. Were there ever, and you might not know just because of the early development of the script, you might not have been privy to, were there any other main ideas considered for the large plot, or was like that golf like push to like kind of change the sport always a big part of it?
I think that's always been a big part of it. I
Gotcha.
mean, that to me, that whole element of Happy having to pull back the traditions of golf because it's been so disrupted
Yeah.
is what makes one and two work together in such a fantastic way.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, to me, that is probably why the movie was made now.
Yeah.
It's kind of like because the disruptions in golf are everywhere,
Yeah, absolutely.
everywhere. And who's to say it's, we're not saying it's not cool. It just is Happy's older, you know? Happy's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Hold on, man. What happened here? Which is cool. I think that's a cool color for Happy. I think that's rad.
Yeah. So at the very end of the movie, we have a shot with Joe Flaherty, Bob Barker, Francis Bay, and Richard Kiel, all characters who have died in the movie, but they've also died in real life. How did you guys get that, like the shot to have them appear in that sequence? Because obviously that's not just footage from the original movie.
Well, there is some footage. We did use the shot from the original movie of Chubbs and
Cubs and the
Alligator
alligator, yeah.
and Abraham Lincoln. But then when we did have to make up our shots, we used some body doubles that had similar bodies, and then had the machine, basically they call it machine learning, which is like computer generated.
Right.
It's computer generated you know, effects
Yeah.
to try and make the face appear like them through the computer learning all of the footage from them in the past.
Yeah, because the facial like attachment to the double worked really well to the point that I was like, wow, did they have like promo footage or something? But because it's really well done.
I think one of the things that we were trying to do was not exploit that technology, but just use it for storytelling, because that's all at the end of the day, we only used it for the story. And used it sparingly so that you're not staring at it a lot. You know,
Not Grand Moff Tarkin in Rogue One.
you're not picking it apart, you
Right.
know. You're having fun.
Right on. Well, they're giving me the light, Kyle. Thanks a lot. It was great talking to you.
Okay, yeah.
And looking forward to
Good
seeing what
talking
you
with
got
you too.
happening
Thank
next.
you. All right, cool. Thank
Take
you.
it easy.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode. You can find more about a lot of the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked in the show notes for this episode. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, next week is going to be at least one day late, hopefully just one, and that's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you then.